This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is a Nova Scotian poem about the east coast of Nova Scotia called At the Fish Houses. Although it's a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting. His net, in the gloaming almost invisible, a dark purple brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish, it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water.
Elizabeth Bishop published just 101 poems in her entire lifetime. She was not especially prolific, and that economy is part of what made her tick. She's famous for her precision, but also her reserve. Right when confessional poetry came into fashion, with Robert Lowell writing about his family and his marriages, or later on Sylvia Plath writing about her father, Elizabeth Bishop kept her personal life out of her writing almost completely, or so it seemed. There's a new biography of Bishop by Megan Marshall, who's discovered a big trove of the poet's unpublished letters, and they suggest that Bishop's poems were maybe a little bit more revealing than they seemed at first, at least in the personal sense. Marshall sat down with NewYorker.com literary editor David Haglund.
Megan, I wanted to start with a line in your book. You tell us, "I had not been close to Elizabeth Bishop. Indeed, I had reason to think she might dislike me." And it's a very striking line to encounter at the beginning of a biography. And I thought maybe you could just describe how you encountered Bishop and why you had that impression.
Well, you're cutting to the chase here. I've often thought that my interest in biography and writing biography began in those years when I was a student poet at Harvard and studying with Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop. I was in their class. I was near them, but still at a distance, kind of a biographer's distance. And I hadn't really thought about writing about Elizabeth Bishop, as you noted there. We hadn't particularly gotten along. I think what I really wanted to say was Elizabeth Bishop was a fascinating personality. She was not a warm presence in the classroom. She began by telling us she didn't believe poetry could be taught. And that was off-putting, but I was one of 11 students who hung on and took the course with her. And I was still part of the group by the end of the semester, and we were all invited to her condominium on Lewis Wharf for a party, where she suddenly was a much warmer person. And I could really see who she was beyond this sort of, shy, almost cold person. She had just published Geography 3, her last book, in which her best-known poem, One Art, appeared. And we were very lucky that one of her poet friends there pressed her to read that poem. And it's a moment that I'll never forget.
Well, the poem's short enough. I wonder if we should go ahead and read it. Do you have it in front of you?
Let me get hold of it. Okay, One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love. I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
It really is such a perfect poem. One thing that is striking about the biography is really coming to understand more of the story behind it, which I really didn't. And even though I had read the poem many times, in a funny way, I mean, she makes the experience of, that she's describing, the experience of losing small things, of losing big things, of losing people and places. It feels universal. And in that way, you're not really pushed necessarily to think about, well, what is she describing from her own life?
Yeah. And in fact, most people have read it as an elegy to Lata de Macedo Soares, her lover and partner in Brazil, who died tragically after their 15-year relationship was coming to an end, probable suicide. So it seemed obvious to people that this, even losing you, that great line at the end, was referring to Lata. But in fact, it was very much about Alice Methfessel, her beloved partner of later years, and her fear, which had been there all along. Alice was much younger. Elizabeth's health was perhaps challenged even when they met when she was in her early 60s. A sense that she would one day lose her. She said that it was pure emotion, and I think that was not typical of her poems.
Well, and that connection between the poem and her relationship with Alice wouldn't really be clear to us except for the letters that you came upon before writing the book, these letters between Elizabeth and Alice that people hadn't seen before.
Yeah, I had thought there need be no new biography written of Elizabeth Bishop until I learned that there was a whole trove of letters that Alice Methfessel, who had been Elizabeth's heir and executor, she had held back a number of really key correspondences when she sold letters to Vassar College. Alice had held on to her own correspondence with Elizabeth, which people didn't know existed, also to last letters that Lotta had written in the last months of her life, and a number of very intense confessional letters she'd written to her psychoanalyst in the 1940s. So these really opened the life up, and it was in the letters to Alice that I began to see how clearly this poem was about a time when Alice, after 4 years or so of the relationship with Elizabeth had a problem with drinking, and this was getting to be too much for Alice, who decided, it seemed for a short while, that she would marry a man, leaving Elizabeth. And that was what provoked 17 drafts of a poem that became one art.
And the letters are very moving. It one of the larger questions that I think the biography raises is Bishop has this long-standing reputation as a very private and guarded person. And as a reader of hers, you inevitably wrestle with the question of to what extent that was simply her temperament or disposition or something that she chose, and to what extent it was in some sense forced upon her because she couldn't be open.
Well, I'll have to tell you, when I started reading these letters in the archive at Vassar, particularly the ones she'd written to her psychoanalyst, which were very revealing about her early relationships with women as a girl. I started to cry. I thought, you know, this can't go out there. The woman that I knew would be appalled. But then I thought, well, you know, do we feel that way about male poets? Do we not write about Yeats and his, you know, proclivities? I mean, why protect Elizabeth Bishop? And in protecting her, what would be gained? I think, in fact, one of the reasons her reputation is so high is that people have come to know Elizabeth through her letters. Why skip these letters? In fact, I think they're all the more important to really understand a woman, what she was you know, in a way, concealing but also revealing in these poems. I mean, I've always loved her poem, The Shampoo, which was, I guess, a little bit too graphic in the 1950s, even though it's hard to tell that it's a love poem. But it was one of the few poems after the point at which she had a first read contract at The New Yorker that was turned away by The New Yorker. And I think because you just couldn't help yourself from realizing this was a woman writing about wanting to shampoo the hair of her, probably her lover. It's a love poem. And I don't know if you'd like to.
Yeah, let's read that one. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. Got to find it in my book. And I think you hear in it these rhythms of Brazil that she has come to love along with her lover, Lotta. The Shampoo. The still explosions on the rocks, the lichens, grow by spreading gray concentric shocks. They have arranged to meet the rings around the moon, although within our memories they have not changed. And since the heavens will attend as long on us, you've been, dear friend, precipitate and pragmatical. And look what happens, for time is nothing if not amenable. The shooting stars in your black hair in bright formation are flocking where? So straight, so soon. Come, let me wash it in this big tin basin, battered and shiny like the moon. What a wonderful way of describing the moon,
right.
You think, even aside from this scene of Elizabeth and Lotta were living in the house that Lotta had designed and was constructing on this kind of remote hillside, mountainside in Brazil. And they truly did have, you know, a marriage more than the later relationship with Alice, which had to be sort of covert. This was, they were open in this relationship and maybe because it was mostly lived up in the hillside and they could be select about who would come and visit them. But this poem was too much for Catherine White at The New Yorker and also too much for the editor of Poetry magazine, and only several years later found publication in The New Republic.
Well, that's in some ways that's the other aspect of Bishop's reputation that for me the reading the biography really challenged, which is that you know, we think of her as very guarded in her work as well, but so much does come through. And, mm-hmm. you know, reading the book, I started to feel like Bishop experienced an unusual amount of tragedy in her life. Her father died when she was just 8 months old, and her mother suffered from mental illness and was institutionalized when Bishop was still quite young. And then there were people throughout her life who died tragically. I don't know if that's just the effect of you know, seeing someone's whole life between two covers, but it started to feel as though she experienced an unusual amount of sadness.
Yeah, I think you're right. And she, for the most part, handled it bravely and gracefully, I think we'd say, and that for her, the writing of these poems was, they were kind of like a life raft that she could float on and sometimes float away. But it's clear that at an early age, art became the saving grace for Elizabeth. It was art, it was the poetry that allowed her to survive, and that she's left us such a great gift.
Before we go, I thought we could listen to a little bit more of Bishop's poetry. We have a recording of Bishop herself reading the poem at the Fish Houses, and it's a long poem, but I thought we could listen to her reading the last section.
Down at the water's edge, at the place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp descending into the water, Thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the gray stones, down and down at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal particularly I've seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music. Like me, a believer in total immersion. So I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I also sang A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge almost in the same spot with a sort of shrug, as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear, gray, icy water. Back behind us, the dignified tall firs begin, bluish, associating with their shadows. A million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I've seen it over and over, the same sea, the same, slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones, and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache, and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be, dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn. And since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown.
God, that knocks me out. Elizabeth Bishop reading At the Fish Houses. The New Yorker's David Haglund spoke with Megan Marshall, author of the new book, Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.